Well, good morning, everyone. This is Pastor John, and it's our Wednesday morning Bible study, and you may be joining us at a later date and time. I hope you are all doing well. We are joined in Bible study this morning by Cheryl and Janelle and Marie and Carol and Bill, and then, of course, Pastor Harvey Nelson as well. So the upcoming text in the narrative lectionary for this coming Sunday is a familiar one to anyone who has been to a wedding. It is 1 Corinthians 13, verses 1 to 13. But before we get to that point, you know, we often like to provide a little bit of context, the stuff we kind of skip over. Last week, our reading was from the first chapter of 1 Corinthians, and we talked a bit about the divisions going on in the church in Corinth and some of the reasons behind some of those divisions. We're going to discover, well, we won't, but if we will, because we're going to take a look at some of the chapters that we skip over between chapter 1 and chapter 13. And so we will hear a little bit more about what some of those divisions are around, because it's not just around the different factions lining up behind different leaders. There are some other divisions going on as well that Paul is going to address. And then eventually we'll get to our reading for this Sunday, which is on the gift of love, which is kind of Paul's response to all of these divisions that are going on in the church in Corinth, and I preached on this last Sunday, right? The central focus of the church should be loving God and loving our neighbor. And that is an antidote to to divisions and conflict. Because if we hold as our central purpose loving God and loving our neighbor, even our conflicts will be done in a different way, a healthier way. If we remember, even as we're arguing and debating, if we remember that I'm called to love the person I'm arguing and debating with, I think that generally leads to a better outcome when it comes to arguments, debates, or conflict. And when we forget that primacy of loving God and loving neighbor, that's when those divisions can really kind of lead towards a lot of bad, evil things. So we've already heard a little bit about some of the divisions in the church in Corinth. There were factions based upon different leaders, a guy named Apollos, who was another itinerant preacher, who we actually hear about in the book of Acts, this Apollos guy, because two of the people that hosted Paul, I think it was, Priscilla and Aquila? Dad, help me out.
Yep.
Yep. So they hear Apollos, they hear Apollos's teaching, and they have to correct him because they've learned a little bit different from Paul. And so they go to Apollos and they kind of say, here's what Paul taught us. And so Apollos learns from Priscilla and Aquila. And then you have others who are claiming to follow Cephas or Peter, and others who claim to follow Paul, and others who claim to follow Jesus. And there this division, I mean, it's not necessarily a bad thing to gravitate towards certain leaders over others, but the factionalism that has occurred within the church in Corinth has led to a breakdown in community. And so that's when it becomes a bad thing, when you're holding your ideology based upon the teachings of a particular leader as more important than, our central purpose of loving God and loving our neighbor. That's when it gets to be problematic within a church faith community. So if we had continued on in the reading from last Sunday, we would have heard Paul talking about Christ, the power and wisdom of God. We ended last week with verse 18, for the message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. And then Paul, in the rest of the first chapter of 1 Corinthians there, kind of expands upon that idea of power and wisdom. And then Paul expands upon what wisdom means in the second chapter of 1 Corinthians, the true wisdom of God. God has revealed to us through the Spirit what human being knows, what is truly human, except the human spirit that is within. And so we cannot comprehend the things of God without the work of the Holy Spirit in us, is Paul's argument in the second chapter. So Paul is introducing the presence of the Spirit within the individual and within the community, which is laying groundwork for what Paul is going to work on later when Paul comes to his argument about spiritual gifts. So Paul is, you know, developing an argument, laying the groundwork here in the second chapter for his argument that's going to come out like eight chapters later. So, you know, he's being good and logical. And then we move into chapter three. Dad, you want to add anything about chapter two? Or
no, I would just say that the book of Corinthians is a letter, and Paul is not sitting down to organize it into a systematic essay. What he's doing is he's responding to the various issues that arise within the Corinthian church. And so he'll talk about this thing for a while, then we'll go on to that thing. He's talked about leadership. He's going to go on talk about the ministry of the apostles, and sexual immorality, and food offered to idols, and so forth. So don't look for logic. He's going to have a logic underneath it all, but the issues that he's confronting are issues that are real to the Corinthian church. And so he's going to be dealing with them in various ways. This is going to lead him up to eventually chapter 12 when he talks about their conflict over spiritual gifts. And that's going to take up the whole section of 12 to 14. But in between, he's talking about other issues.
So in chapter 3, he gets back into his discussion of the factionalism that's occurring in Corinth, and he talks a little bit more about, you know, when one says, I belong to Paul, and another, I belong to Apollos, are you not merely human? What then is Apollos? What is Paul? Servants through whom you came to believe as the Lord assigned to teach. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. You know, so Paul's trying to make the argument that it doesn't matter, you know, who you gravitate towards. The purpose of Paul, the purpose of Apollos and Cephas is all the same. And that is the growth of the church, the growth of spiritual gifts and discipline within the church in Corinth. So, I mean, Paul is arguing that it's more of a building relationship than a Paul versus Apollos. It's rather, you know, we build off of what each one is teaching. And so that's what the argument he will make again in chapter 3. And then he talks a little bit more broadly about the ministry of the apostles in chapter 4. And he talks a little bit more about Apollos within that. And yeah. And then he calls all of this an admonition. And towards the end of chapter 4, I'm not writing this to make you feel ashamed, but to admonish you as my beloved children. So he's, you know, he wants them to be better. And then he encourages them to be imitators of Paul. And then he also promises to come and visit them again soon. Then we enter into some more of the divisions that seem to be plaguing the church in Corinth, besides that factionalism that has cropped up. And in chapter 5, we've got one of the divisions is about sexual immorality and you know what that means for the church in Corinth.
It's good to know that in Corinth was a port city, and it had people from all over the world, and it was infamous for its idol worship, but also for its sexual immorality. And the church in Corinth was made up of all kinds of people. It was very diverse, and so they all had different ideas about what was proper sexuality and sexual conduct. And so Paul is trying to set the record straight about some of those things as the arguments go on in the Corinthian church.
And then chapter 6 is another source of division, lawsuits among believers. You know, and Paul is saying you shouldn't be going to the Roman court. You should kind of figure it out in your own community. You know, you should be able to resolve conflict within your own community without going to, as Paul will talk about it, without going to the unrighteous and the pagans. So rather than, you know, going to the court system to handle conflict, especially conflict that's gotten to the point of like a lawsuit, you know, rather you should be attempting to resolve that within your own community, which would sure be nice, but of course it's not always practical. That's where we get a relatively famous verse that gets twisted plenty of times in chapter 6, verse 12. All things are lawful for me, but not all things are beneficial. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be dominated by anything. So, you know, and he talks then about what that means, and then goes back into kind of sexual immorality, you know, fidelity and adultery, and how those are, you know, those causes divisions as well. And then he continues on in that theme in chapter 7, directions concerning marriage.
And again, it's good to keep in mind that in Corinth, there was all kinds of different attitudes towards marriage as well. There were around, of course, people who were polygamists at one end, and at the other end, there were some Stoics who said one should refrain from all sexual activity. And in between, there were a multitude of different views. So it's not surprising that Paul is trying to talk about marriage, and he indicates that he himself is single and he wishes other people would be so, but the time is short before Jesus comes, so you got to figure out what's the best to do in the meanwhile. It's okay if you marry. So he is saying that's okay too. So mixing a little personal reality with the larger societal happenings.
Yeah, the early church also had a little bit of issue with celibate members of the church kind of lording it over those who are married and saying, you know, I'm a more faithful person because I have this, because I can remain celibate. And Paul is trying to nip that argument in the bud here a little bit, you know, because he says, you know, basically, I wish that everyone were single and celibate like me, but not everyone has the gift or the gift of remaining celibate their entire life. And you shouldn't lord it over someone if you remain celibate but somebody else doesn't. It's just a different spiritual gift. It's not something to lord over other people or to, you know, be arrogant or prideful about. Rather, and this argument will get developed later on, but rather you exercise your gifts on behalf of the people who don't have those gifts, right? So someone who is celibate, they exercise the gift of celibacy on behalf of everyone in the community, even those who don't have that same spiritual gift. So, you know, one of the interesting debates going on in the early church is you know, what is the place of that? And then another argument that Paul gets into in this chapter is about whether or not believers should divorce their spouse if their spouse is not a believer, and Paul will make the argument that they should remain married, and he even makes the argument the unbelieving husband is made holy through his wife and the unbelieving wife is made holy through her husband. So he's encouraging kind of mixed marriages to stay together, you know. He goes on further into this topic in the rest of the chapter, and then he gets into concerning food sacrificed to idols. As my father mentioned, Corinth is known for its idols. There being idols everywhere, and so if meat has been ritually sacrificed and prepared as an offering to a god, are Christians allowed to eat that meat? Is the question. You know, there were temples and idols all over the place in Corinth, and animals were sacrificed to those gods. And then the meat from those sacrifices was often kind of shared in communal meals in those temples. Though Paul saw these altars and idols as powerless and the offerings as just food, he warned that people who do eat food, Christians who do eat food offered to idols, he warned them to be careful about it because there might be those who are weaker in the Christian faith, who are watching and who will take away kind of the wrong idea about that, you know, who might come to the conclusion that, oh, these Christians are eating this food sacrificed to Zeus. Zeus must be okay. Zeus must be real. And so that's kind of Paul's argument for this, walking a fine line here between the knowledge that these idols are just idols, they're wood and stone, the food is just food, but how would it then look for Christians to be eating food sacrificed to other gods, especially to those who are younger in the faith?
And that leads them on to the theme of insisting upon your freedom at the expense of others' faith. And he's going to use that same kind of logic to talk about himself as an apostle in chapter 9, that he's free in a lot of ways, but he doesn't want to use his freedom to keep other people from knowing Christ and God. And so that's a principle that he's trying to insist upon, that your freedom, his freedom, is not the most important thing. What's important is that people know Christ. And if he has to make adjustments to have that happen, he'd be willing to do that.
And it's this chapter of 1 Corinthians, chapter 9, that inspires Martin Luther to write On the Freedom of a Christian, in which Luther writes, "A Christian is a perfectly free lord of all, subject to none. A Christian is a perfectly dutiful servant of all, subject to all." And so Luther adopts some of the language of Paul here, saying that, you know, Christians are perfectly free because we've been freed by the, you know, the blood of the Lamb and the resurrection, and we've been made free of sin, death, and the devil. But that freedom leads us then to serve other people. That's freed from, freed for. We've been freed from sin, death, and the devil, and freed for the sake of our neighbor. So that's Luther and Paul here in chapter 9 of 1 Corinthians. Chapter 10, Paul talks about ancestors and about some of the history of Israel and some of the conflict that occurred within the history of Israel, and uses some of the examples from that history to talk a little bit about what's going on in the church in Corinth. He reiterates, all things are lawful, but not all things are beneficial. All things are lawful, but not all things build up. And then verse 24 of chapter 10, do not seek your own advantage, but that of the other. If an unbeliever invites you to a meal and you are disposed to go, eat whatever is set before you without raising any question. So he's continuing that argument there about how to operate in within a different culture that has different norms. Whatever you do, do everything for the glory of God in verse 31. So, and then we get into chapter 11, the first portion of which has Paul being a little bit misogynistic and a creature of his own culture, because he insists that women should cover their hair in worship, you get some of the culture of Paul's time that we today don't lend as much weight to what Paul says here, about.
Part of it is also that Paul, keep in mind that he's telling people, go back to verse 31, chapter 10. So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do everything to the glory of God. Give no offense to Jews or Greeks or the church of God, just as I try to please everyone and everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, but that of many, so that they may be saved. Be imitators of me, as I am of Christ. So in his particular culture, it would have been quite the thing for a woman to stand up and lead things in a public forum such as this. And so he's being a creature of his culture, and not trying to offend the larger cultural setting. But if we're going to follow his logic in our day and age, when men and women are equal, are supposedly equal, then we would come to the exact opposite conclusion, that if we don't want, well, we want to get both men and women to be saved, then we better do that which is not offensive culturally.
Yeah, this interplay between Christianity and culture is a fascinating one. And there's a, what's the title of that book? Well, I think it is Christ and Culture. Is it by Richard Niebuhr?
Niebuhr, yeah.
And he Christ and Culture by Richard Niebuhr. And he explores kind of the different ways in history that it's been understood, this interplay between Christ and culture. Is it the Christ of culture? Is it Christ against culture? Is it Christ above culture? Is it Christ and culture in paradox? Or is it Christ transforming culture? Those are the kind of the things that Niebuhr identifies as the ways in which there's that interplay between Christianity, faith, and culture. And, I could go down this rabbit hole, but we don't need to. It's an interesting, it's a very good book. If you've got some free time now, Christ and Culture by Niebuhr is a worthwhile read to think about this. It's not the easiest read in the world, but it is a good read.
Then he turns his attention to worship activities in the Corinthian church, and he's been doing that at all of chapter 11, talking about women speaking and so forth. But then he goes into the Lord's Supper and how they're doing that wrong, because people come and the rich eat a lot of food and the poor eat nothing, and that isn't right. And he says this isn't the meal that Christ intended, and then he passes on a tradition of the Lord's Supper, which is probably the earliest account we have of the words of institution, because the First Corinthians is probably written about 52 AD, so within 20 years of around 20 years of Christ's death. So this is probably much earlier than Mark or Matthew or Luke or John, and how they record what was going on. But in any event, his point is that they should examine themselves and discern that they are the body of Christ, and that they should act accordingly as Christ's body and not impart human division between rich and poor and so forth in communion.
And then chapter 12, we get into spiritual gift language that Paul has already kind of been laying the groundwork for, and then one body with many members. And I referenced those things in my sermon last Sunday about how Paul is going to try to address the divisions and what the be of one mind and one purpose. What does that mean? Here we get a greater sense of that 11 chapters later in chapter 12, where being of one mind and one purpose does not mean that we're all the same, but that we are, we have different gifts, and that's good. We're different. We have different members. We're different members of the same body of Christ, and that's good. We need that diversity. We need that variety, but we have to keep what's central, right? We have to have a unit. If we're not unified in spiritual gifts, if we're not all the same in that way, what then unifies us as a community of faith? It's our purpose, loving God and loving our neighbor, which moves us then into chapter 13, which is our reading for it. Sorry?
Yeah, it is our. What I'd like to do is we take this chapter 13 so much out of context. We got to make sure that we have it in context. We're going to understand what it says. So I'd like to at least read, start from 12:27, and I'll read down to where Pastor John can pick up with the actual text itself. But Paul is just has been using this analogy of the body with its different members and how they all need to work together. That's what the church should do as well. In verse 27, he says, "Now you are the body of Christ and individually members of it. And God has appointed in the church first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, then deeds of power, then gifts of healing, forms of assistant, forms of leadership, various kinds of tongues. Are all apostles? Are all prophets? Are all teachers? Do all work miracles? Do all possess gifts of healing? Do all speak in tongues? Do all interpret? But strive for the greater gifts, and I will show you a still more excellent way. That's how he ends his discussion, and that's what that leads into our text.
If I speak in the tongues of mortals and of angels, but do not have love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give away all my possessions, and if I hand over my body so that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. But as for prophecies, they will come to an end. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will come to an end. For we know only in part, and we prophesy only in part. But when the complete comes, the partial will come to an end. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult, I put an end to childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we will see face to face. Now I know only in part. Then I will know fully, even as I have been fully known. And now faith, hope, and love abide, these three. And the greatest of these is love.
Chapter 14, he goes on to say right after this, pursue love and strive for the spiritual gifts, especially that you may prophesy. So the whole context of this is a dispute about spiritual gifts and seeing the church as one body, and that in a sense you can say the blood that flows through the whole body is love.
Yeah, and this chapter has been read so often at weddings that we often kind of associate it with that sort of love. But that, of course, is actually not at all what Paul is talking about, because, you know, it's one of the troubles with English, right, is we've got the one word for love. But I think we all understand that there are different types of love. I love pizza, but not in the same way that I love my children. And I love my children, but not quite in the same way that I love my wife. I mean, there are different kinds of love. And you know, the three most common used in the New Testament in Greek is eros, which is where we get the word erotic from. So that's the passionate love, romantic love. And then philos, which is brotherly love. You know, the city of Philadelphia is the city of brotherly love. Philos, that familial love or friendly sort of love. Or sometimes that can also kind of include a filial love, you know, the sort of love that you have for your family out of duty. and then there's agape love, which is the word used here in 1 Corinthians 13. It's unconditional love. Unmerited, unearned, and by and large, this love is used to talk about how God loves humanity, and it's tricky for humanity to express that love to God or to others. I'm not going to say it's impossible, but it's very hard for us to love unconditionally other people and God, for that matter. I think maybe we can get maybe tastes of it, glimpses of what that love is like. But by and large, that love is very difficult for humans because we are broken. and a lot of times our love has to do with relationships, right? And so they become somewhat conditional because I'm in a relationship with you, I love you. And that's not unconditional love. So Yeah, so that's the love that Paul is talking about here. It's agape love, unconditional, unearned, unmerited love for neighbor, for God. And that's what Paul is saying we are to strive for. And then, of course, Paul goes on to describe what that love looks like.
And he does, in his description, he's going back to what he just talked about before in terms of the different spiritual gifts that they're in conflict about. So he says, if I speak in tongues, I have not love, I'm nothing more than a clanging cymbal. So he's going to go back to tongues. He's going to go back to the various gifts, workers and miracles and so forth, and knowledge and all the rest. So this love poem, as we like to think of it, is really a very specific thing to a particular congregation with issues. And then he goes, if I have prophetic powers, understand all mysteries, and I'll knowledge, and if I have faith, as remove mountains, and if I have love, I'm nothing. So he's saying, you may have all these gifts, but you better have them with love, or they're of no value. I give away all my possessions. I had my body over so I may boast. But I do not have love. I am. So you may have lots of different gifts, but if you don't use them in love, you're not using them properly.
Verses 4 through 7 then goes on to talk about some of the qualities of this agape love. So love is patient, kind, not envious, not rude. It does not insist on its own way. And that's that's a tricky part of this, isn't it? Does not rejoice in wrongdoing. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. So those are quite the qualities of this agape love. And it's these qualities of agape love that really make it so difficult for us to achieve. Because I'm not always patient. I'm not always kind. I am sometimes envious, boastful, arrogant, and rude. I do sometimes insist on my own way. I'm sometimes irritable and resentful. I do sometimes rejoice in wrongdoing, and sometimes I fail to rejoice in the truth. I don't bear all things, believe all things, hope all things, or endure all things. Sometimes I do that, but by and large, I don't.
I think we look at when he talks about these things, love is patient, kind, not envious or boastful. When you look at love, love is concerned about the well-being and caring for and working towards the well-being of the other. It's putting the other before me. And that's not always an easy thing to do, because we like to center on me. And if he looks at the positive, the negative thing, love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Again, it's not looking at itself, but it's looking beyond itself. And that is a challenge to us people who are pretty good at being selfish.
And on the other hand, we hear now about, I guess I'm thinking of women, particularly in abusive situations, that if they were to read this, you know, they have to be patient and enduring, and yet what they need to do is stand up and in many cases leave their situation, which is very difficult too. So makes it this chapter, you know, can give a person difficulty.
Yeah, and there are other texts, unfortunately, that reinforce that same idea. And so it's always good to have something of a disclaimer that you know, you can love someone and you can try to be patient and kind and enduring and everything, but sometimes what's the best way to love someone is to not be around them anymore. And that also, you know, is authentic love for yourself too, not in a selfish way, but loving yourself enough to not allow yourself to be mistreated, because the other person in that situation is, of course, not being patient, kind, all of the agape love qualities that are being described here as well. So And that leads, you know, to other questions about forgiveness and reconciliation. And I've had this conversation with people, and I've had to say, you know, you should always strive to forgive, but that does not mean that we can always be reconciled. We should, at least not in this life. Who knows, in the next life, maybe we can be reconciled then. But if it's not safe to be reconciled with someone, then it's not the wise course of action.
I like what you said, that a relationship has to be mutual. You know, and Paul earlier, he was talking about, what do you do if one person in a couple is Christian and the other one is not? And then it's the same thing. Are both people working for the mutual growth and good life of a relationship?
I think also one of the dangers one gets to is that this Paul speaking to a specific situation of a church conflict, and he's telling them how to operate in love in that conflict. I don't know that we necessarily need to take that advice and see it applies to every conflict. It applies in marriage and so forth. His point is right, that love is patient and kind and so forth, and love is other oriented. But that does not become a way of advocating that stay in an abusive relationship, because he's not talking about abusive relationships here. He's talking about conflict over spiritual gifts.
And divisions within a community too. The last verses, yeah. Oh, sorry.
I think that that's been one way Christians have been doing it wrong for hundreds of years. They look at one chapter, you know, well, before we didn't really understand the flow and the context of this whole book. And I just think it's really good that we have to keep saying our Lutheran hermeneutic, that look to what Jesus said, look to what Jesus did, and then let that reflect on the writings of Paul.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Paul is Paul. He's not Jesus. And Paul will admit that, and does admit it freely several times. You know, 90% of what Paul writes is great and awesome, but there's a good 10% that is not. And we have to,
especially when you pick five verses out of the whole book.
Right.
You know, say this is the way we have to do it. You know, you better move on to chapter 13 and 14.
Paul ends here in these last verses, you know, 8:13, he talks about the eternity of love versus other things. And when I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult, I put an end to childish ways. And then he launches into what seems to be an allusion to classic Greek philosophy, and talks about, you know, for now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we will see face to face. I always hear in that, you know, echoes of it's Plato, right, with the shadows on the wall. You know, we can't see reality clearly. That's one of the fundamentals of Greek philosophy, and it's only the philosopher who spends oodles and oodles of time in self-reflection and in deep thinking that can see things clearly. Paul would argue that none of us can see things clearly. And, you know, it's only it's in the next life that we see face to face, and we'll only know fully when we've been seen fully. And then he ends with this powerful: faith, hope, and love abide, these three, and the greatest of these is love. Paul places love above faith, which I find interesting.
I think he does that precisely because he's speaking to this issue of divisions over spiritual gifts. And in that particular situation, love is the most important thing. Is that always the most important thing in every particular situation? No. But it is good. I think you can take it into the church community and say, as we get into more conflicts, we better make sure that we're trying to operate out of love and not insisting upon our own way.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, I'm reading this chapter as an antidote to what's known as the opinio legis, or the opinion of the law, which is a Latin phrase and a Lutheran concept. This, or you know, perhaps easier than opinion of the law, mindset of the law, in which that is the mindset that most of us have. And it's a mindset that leads to division, frankly, quite a bit, because we've been given this gift from God, the law, in order to order our lives and communities in healthy ways. But instead of using it in healthy ways, we take this gift of the law and we turn it into a weapon, and we use it to assign blame to others and to judge other people based upon, you know, comparing and contrasting the ability to follow and keep the law, and that leads to this mindset of blame and judgment. And it's so utterly, completely, horribly human of us to take this good gift that God's given us and pervert it into a weapon to harm other people. And so that mindset of blame and judgment, the antidote to that is love, right? And that's getting back to Paul's earlier argument about, you know, all things are lawful, but not all things are beneficial. We counteract that inclination to blame and judge other people by focusing on the fact that God loves that person, and I'm called to love that person too. And if I view my neighbors, you know, with that lens of love, it becomes harder for me to assign blame and judgment, and harder for me to use the mindset of the law, the opinio legis. Am I way off base on my explanation of opinio legis, Dad?
I think saying that it's a mindset is a good thing.
And it's a mindset we frequently have and fall back into. We can be striving not to have that mindset and living in grace and love, but it's such a great temptation to blame and judge other people, isn't it? I mean, I do it all the time. I love to do it because it's a good way to protect myself, right?
Yeah.
I can focus on blaming and judging other people. I don't have to think about how I have fallen short of the glory of God.
And it's a dangerous one to get into, because we end up trying to take place of God then. We can judge others. And in the end, judgment is God's thing. And God will have the good and right word. I won't. I'm just going by what I feel and think. And that's probably not very sure or certain. Certainly not in the face of God. Anyway, so next wedding you go to, see if you hear. 13.
I'm pretty sure I have to confess that it was one of the readings at our wedding.
Truth be told, there isn't that much in the Bible that is specifically about weddings. And so you have to search around for other texts that you import and use in weddings.
Well, I don't have anything further. Any last questions or comments from anyone else?
Are you going to continue and finish off 1 Corinthians? Or
I don't.
Going on.
I don't think so. We've only got 2 Sundays after this one until Pentecost. What is the one in between? I don't even remember. Between this Sunday and Pentecost is what? The 24th is 1 Corinthians 15. So yeah, we are staying in 1 Corinthians, where Paul is talking about resurrection, because that was another source of division in the church in Corinth. Do we really believe that many of
the chapters are the issues that were going on in Corinth, and resurrection was an issue too?
Yeah, another bit of trivia: 1 and 2 Corinthians likely come to us from three different letters that Paul wrote that were kind of put together. Trivia.
Well, I think it's interesting that he's addressing all these issues to, and then the 15th chapter is dealing with resurrection, and then boom, chapter 16, the collection for the saints. I think that's interesting. It's finally back to down to earth. Send your money.
Generosity, charity is a spiritual gift. All right, I think I'll close the recording. So thanks for joining us, everyone.